This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 25th of February 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
The United Nations Security Council was created to protect civilians, to provide peace and security, and they have dismally failed.
Amnesty International is calling on the five permanent members of the UN Security Council to forfeit their vetoes. They're probably right, but will it happen? Tim Marshall and Isabel Hilton are in the studio to give us their take. We'll also discuss Benjamin Netanyahu's controversial upcoming visit to Washington. Plus, we'll check in with our man in Madrid and discuss the upcoming return of TV's most terrifying fictional president, Frank Underwood, from the hit Netflix series House of Cards. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. But first, here's Paul Osborne with the latest news from around the world.
It's now thought that hundreds of Syrian Christians have been kidnapped by Islamic State militants, many more than originally thought. Up to 200 Assyrian Christians may have been seized in raids on a number of villages in the north of the country. Local sources say that most of those taken were women, children and the elderly. Around 1,000 Assyrian families are believed to have fled their homes. Bosses at HSBC have apologised for the tax avoidance scandal at its Swiss private bank. Leaked documents suggested hundreds of wealthy clients have been held to avoid paying huge amounts in tax. Two senior managers have been questioned by members of the British Parliament. Group Chief Executive Stuart Gulliver says the scandal has harmed trust and confidence in HSBC, and he wants to say sorry.
To our customers, our shareholders, to the public at large, it clearly was unacceptable. We very much regret this, and it has damaged HSBC's reputation.
So just to be clear, what are you apologising for?
The lack of controls and the practices which now, judged with the benefit of hindsight, we would not be at all comfortable with if they were happening today.
Austria's parliament has passed a controversial series of reforms to the country's law on Islam. The changes are partly designed to tackle radicalisation, but there's been criticism of the move to ban foreign funding for mosques and imams. Muslim leaders claim it's unfair treatment, as Christian and Jewish groups are allowed to accept international support. They're considering a challenge in Austria's constitutional court. A senior advisor to President Obama says relations between the US and Israel will be harmed by a planned speech in Congress by the country's prime minister. Benjamin Netanyahu was invited by the Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives and is expected to criticize Mr. Obama's support for talks with Iran on its nuclear program. But Susan Rice, the president's national security advisor, has said that would be destructive to the fabric of US-Israeli relations. The Ukrainian army says that for the first time in several weeks it has suffered no fatalities over a 24-hour period. It's a boost for the fragile ceasefire in eastern Ukraine, but government sources are questioning claims from pro-Russian rebels to have withdrawn heavy weapons from the front line. Meanwhile, more details have now emerged of the plan to send a limited number of British troops to Ukraine. The country's defence secretary, Michael Fallon.
United Kingdom personnel will now provide medical, logistics, infantry and intelligence capacity building training from mid-March to the Ukrainian Armed Forces. Most of the advisory and training support will take place in Ukraine, but well away from the areas affected by the conflict in the east of the country.
More than 100 people are believed to have been killed in avalanches triggered by heavy snowfall north of Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. Heavy snow in Panjshir province has blocked roads and cut off entire villages. Rescue work is being hampered by continued dangerous conditions, and officials say that more people may have died, with news only slowly emerging from the worst affected areas. Hundreds of people have joined a vigil in the east of the Czech Republic after the country's worst ever shooting. The killer, a 63-year-old man, fired indiscriminately at diners in a restaurant in Uherský Brod, killing 8 people before shooting himself. The town's mayor has called it their darkest day. The Greek government has indefinitely suspended professional football in the country. It's after violence at the match between rival teams Olympiacos and Panathinaikos and a brawl between club officials at a meeting earlier this week. It is the third time this season that the Greek league has been suspended because of violence. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Op London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Just turned 18.06 here in London, 13.06 in New York City. Joining me today are Tim Marshall and Isabel Hilton. Tim Marshall is the diplomatic editor at Sky News, but very soon will be the editor of the whatandthewhy.com. And Isabel Hilton is the editor of China Dialogue. Isabel and Tim, welcome to you both. Thank you. We'll begin with the call from Amnesty International, which is pulling no punches with the release of its latest report, calling 2014 a shameful year for the world's most powerful nations after a failure to adequately respond to international crises. A refusal to house a reasonable number of refugees was among a number of criticisms thrown at the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council. And the group is now calling on those members to relinquish their veto power in cases where atrocities are being committed. Tim Marshall, this is it's very nice of Amnesty to say that these countries should give up their veto powers, but in a million years it's never going to happen, is it?
Not in a million years and not in the next 10 years. And I think there's even a greater chance of someone like the UK giving up its permanent place on the Security Council than them all agreeing to give up the veto. It is part of the post-Second World War the way the world is framed and organised. It is time for it to be reformed. It would help if they didn't have the veto. But the fact is that countries use their vetoes quite sparingly. They use the threat of the veto to make sure that certain documents never get to be voted on in the first place. And it always comes down to which side they're on. Therefore, Russia knows that it wants a favour from China next year. So if there's anything that's going to condemn China for that, they will say, OK, well, don't worry, we'll join you in veto. And next year you'll join us. Britain and America and to an extent France all play the same thing. So Amnesty can say what they like. It's not going to change.
Although, Isabel, it's interesting that Amnesty aren't the only group that's called for this. In fact, one of the five countries with a veto, France, last year said that in times where there is a humanitarian catastrophe, something akin to a genocide, the veto shouldn't count. The problem is, who decides what is a humanitarian catastrophe?
Well, precisely. And, you know, one man's humanitarian catastrophe is another man's freedom fight or whatever it is. I mean, they couldn't act. And the most notorious genocides, which go back a bit, but in Rwanda, for instance, which was clearly a genocide, which was a well-announced genocide. But who dragged their feet on that? It was the United States. So, you know, it's...
Well, and the French as well.
And the French. But it's easy to say it's always Russia and China. In fact, China's use of the veto has historically been rather sparing. It was only when, you know, direct interests were involved. The United States' threat of the veto is in defense of Israel, something that actually this Amnesty report has quite a lot to say about, because if you look at Israel's recent actions in Gaza, you know, there are certainly people who argue very strongly that these were crimes against humanity. But it's all about alliances and interests, and it's about alliances and interests on both sides. So you get pleasant small countries like New Zealand, which has now got one of the temporary seats where the foreign minister says, yes, the veto is a problem. People will say the veto is a problem, but like everything in the United Nations, we all know there are lots of problems. We all know it needs reform, and it's pretty impossible to get from here to there.
Tim Marshall, when reform is talked about, I must say, I often look at what's being proposed and think, that's going to be even worse because the reform that's being talked about mainly at the moment is expanding the Security Council from 15 members, possibly to as many as 25, having more permanent members.
15 of them.
You know, who are also going to have a veto or you know, probably some form of almost veto. Yeah. That may make, in some ways, the council... You know, it could be argued more accountable if Brazil and India and Japan and
more
Germany are also on
yes.
it, but more representative perhaps. But it's not necessarily going to make this body that doesn't function very well at the moment function any better, is it?
By coincidence, today is the anniversary of the forming of the League of Nations in 1919, which if you'd looked at the whatonthewhy.com today, you would have noticed because I've mentioned it. Do you see what I did there, Steve? And we're not yet... at a place where the United Nations is about to collapse the way that the League of Nations did. And it was an abject failure in the 1930s. But we are approaching that space where people start to think, what's the point of the UN? Well, there's a massive point to the UN. The UN does amazing work all over the world in peacekeeping, in helping people in various situations. The real reform does need to come in the Security Council. But the problem, and Isabel's touched on this about the alliances, comes, supposing you were to do what the Amnesty say, which is to get rid of the veto, and then you had a 3-2 vote, 3-4-2 against, for example, you've immediately run into the sand of the blocks there. So the three that said, yes, we should do something, will then go and get the posse rounded up of people that would agree, and the two that didn't would make sure that no one, none of their friends helped them, and you'd still be in a similar situation. And as you point out, if the security count, if the P, the permanent, the P5, become the P15, you're just going to get even more complicated. I'm afraid it's an unwieldy, difficult organisation that does a very difficult job, sometimes adequately.
Isabel, is there an argument to be made that when nations within the Permanent Five don't have direct interest on those issues, it can work quite well? So on issues of counter-terrorism, you know, British officials will say that actually they've worked with their Russian counterparts quite well. On issues to do with, you know, peace in, for example, Burundi, you know, you'll have, you know, all the Permanent Five saying, actually, we've been able to come to an agreement on this because none of us have big strategic interests there and that's okay. Is that, or am I sort of really sort of looking for
silver linings? No, I think that's fair. I think that's fair. The problem is that those cases are relatively few. Given the world as it is, and given the nature of the problems that come to the UN. I mean, they're about conflict, and in conflict, and particularly the conflicts we have at the moment, you have a very complex set of alliances and interests. So yes, that can be true. But the fact that we're talking about expanding the Security Council to 15, it is about greater representativeness, but it's also about the impossibility of getting anyone to give up their seat. So rather than, you know, toss out the people who should be tossed out, which includes Britain and France, there should be a Europe
well,
seat.
Well, the EU. Yeah, the EU says it should have a seat.
Exactly. But rather than everyone volunteering to fall on their sword, the solution is to expand. And that is, you know, that's just a reflection of the way the members behave. And the UN as a body gets a bad rep because, yes, it can seem impotent and useless. It's only as impotent and useless as its member states make it. And that, I think, is the price of universality, is that you're not going to move fast on many occasions.
We'd miss it if it was gone.
Yeah, absolutely. And all the things that it does do, which are not to do with the Security Council, not to do with the P5, wouldn't happen. And those are essential.
There's various films, you've probably seen them, including the Austin Powers film, where, you know, that massive building on the Hudson River in Manhattan just suddenly disappears because a giant laser's got rid of it. It wouldn't just be a gaping hole there. It would be a gaping hole in the international structure, and the world would be a worse place without it.
Just briefly, before we move on to onto the next one, I'm going to put you slightly on the spot here. Let's say the United Nations were to disappear overnight and we had to start again from scratch. And Tim, I'm going to start with you on this.
Thanks. So she gets more time to think. What's the question?
What would it look like, or what should it look like?
It should look like something that had a better representation of the world. Perhaps there should be representatives of blocs. I mean, there are in a way already, but there's perhaps a rotational country on Africa sits on a permanent 15, a rotational country in Latin America sits on it, Europe. You couldn't get away from China and America, you'd be very hard pressed not to put Russia in there. I would get away from the veto, and I would try to streamline it as much as possible, and then it would still run into all the arguments, and you would still get the Human Rights Council being hosted by Libya under Gaddafi, which is, you know, that sort of thing happened. But it, yes, there is a way of reforming, there is a way of streamlining, and it does need to be more represented, because it's all about who won the Second World War, but it's not all about that now.
And Isabel Hilton, you know, would you have a council making decisions that didn't have Britain but would have Russia and China?
Yes, it would have Europe. And Europe could be a rotational, I mean, Britain could be a rotational representative of the European interest. What you failed with that formula to solve, however, is what you do about Asia, because all you have is China. What about Japan? I mean, that's one of the contentious issues now. What about Malaysia, Indonesia?
Bhutan.
What about India?
Bhutan as the only representative. What about India? So the problem with Asia is a very complicated one, and no country in Asia would accept an Asian seat and the rotation. So you still haven't quite got I would say 2/3 of the way there, but okay. The last third's really tricky.
Well, 2/3 is something. Now let's move on. Within the international coalition joining the fight against ISIS, Turkey has been somewhat quiet. The border between Turkey and Syria is, of course, the main gateway for those wishing to join the ISIS front, and many have viewed Turkey as a lame duck in the struggle against ISIS as the rest of the world takes action. But an effort by Turkey at the weekend to rescue 600 Turkish soldiers in Syria is now being seen as an indication of the country's willingness to take a slightly quieter tone against the group. Isabel Hilton, are we perhaps a little unfair on Turkey here, in that it's all very well if you're in Washington or Brussels or London to say, well, what's happening in Syria is outrageous, something must be done, but if you share a 500-mile border with this country, you might be a little quieter?
Yes, I think that's true. And I think that the Western view tends to, you know, we have this extended, complex, multifaceted war, which is going on, you know, pretty much on a swathe from Afghanistan to the Mediterranean. We like to choose good guys and bad guys. We like to, you know, have clear cut. We're in support of one lot and against the other. And it is a mosaic of competing interests and actually quiet and sometimes squalid deals. You know, our view of President Assad seems to be shifting. We've discussed that before. You know, new enemies come up and old enemies become possible allies. So if you're right in the middle of it, as Turkey is, not only as a border country, but also with the complications of the Kurds and the you know, internal complications of a traditionally secular country drifting back to Islam, I think we probably should cut Turkey a little slack and be grateful that they, you know, don't do anything too embarrassing. It's not the first time they've been accused of having conversations with ISIS, actually, and videos have been posted showing quite chummy relationships between border guards and ISIS and so on. So it's not really new.
Indeed, and also, Tim, you know, Turkey, when it was invited to join the fight against ISIS, as it was, said, OK, fine, but we also want you to join us in the fight against Assad, and we also want you to join us in the fight against the Kurds.
We're prepared to defend it to the last Turkish soldier, it would appear. I concur with what Isabel said, but apart from, I do take a dim view of a NATO member pretty much putting up signs at Istanbul and Ankara airports saying jihadists this way. You know, would you like a taxi to the border? Yeah. Yeah. This is the conveyor belt. If you would like to go over there and fight, walk this way. I mean, obviously I'm exaggerating, but they could do an awful lot more. The Turkish intelligence service is pretty good. You know, it's pretty repressive inside Turkey. And it could do a lot more to stop that funnel of foreign fighters, money and aid getting to Islamic State. And as a NATO ally of the United States and Britain and all the others that are taking action there, I think they should. Where I have some sympathy for them is that they are in the middle of a massive mess and it is on their border. I'm pretty sure what happened on Saturday night was it was 37 tanks, 57 armoured vehicles, there was air cover, the special forces were involved. They went 20 miles into Syria. They got the remains of Suleiman. They rescued the 38 Turkish soldiers and they've brought them out. Stalin had a maxim, if you've got a man, you've got a problem. They've inverted that. They no longer have the man and they've moved the problem, because what was going to happen, the fighting was going to reach the tomb of Suleiman. The 38 Turkish soldiers were going to get involved. At that point, Turkey was going to have to get involved. It doesn't want to get involved. So it went in, removed the problem, and can now keep saying, we're not going to get involved. Foreign Policy magazine wrote about this yesterday and said this is proof that they are now ready to enter the fight in Syria. I take it as proof as the opposite. They're making sure they don't want to get dragged in.
And Turkey, Isabel, has always played this... double game sounds offensive.
No, that's fair enough.
I don't quite mean it like that, but they, you know, as Tim points out, they are a long-standing member of NATO. They've got the second largest army in NATO, see themselves as very much part of the West, and yet the West has often, not necessarily... You're shaking your head at my suggestion.
Well, I mean, yes and no. Of course, most of Turkey lies in Asia, in fact. And as the European Union tends to remember when Turkey's membership of the European Union comes up. Well, how long has that been pending?
But
Turkey's part of the West.
Well, Turkey will say on that, you know, in 1997, when the EU announced who the new states were going to be and all the Baltic states were in and lots of Eastern Europe were in, and they were like, well, hang on, why aren't we in?
That was a pretty wounding moment. And the Turkish application, which has been around pretty much as long as I've been noticing, and progressed not at all. So we will take Turkish workers, you know, famously Gastarbeiter in Germany with no privileges or rights for a long time. We will treat Turkey as a very second-class citizen, except when, you know, in the Cold War, when we wanted the listening post, it was strategically located and all those things. So ambivalence on both sides, I would say.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Every March, Monocle puts the spotlight on one nation, and this time, it's the turn of Japan. As the country looks forward to welcoming the world at the 2020 Olympic Games, we focus on the challenges facing modern Japan. Here's what our editors have reported on.
In the design section, we trek the length and breadth of Japan to discover its craft capitals, those towns known in true Japanese style for making one thing and making it well.
In the edits pages, we follow the Sumida River to Tokyo's Old Town to profile the up-and-coming Kuramai neighbourhood.
The March issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or become a subscriber. Head to monocle.com to find out how.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, my guest today, Tim Marshall and Isabel Hilton. Tim, briefly, before we go on to the big story that we all want to discuss today, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is visiting Washington next week. And it's a controversial visit, isn't it? Because it's in the midst of a general election campaign. He's going to speak to Congress. Congress has invited him. Forgot to mention this to the White House.
Forgot to tell his Director of National Intelligence.
Yes. Now two Democratic senators have said, hey, BB, when you're here, why don't you meet us as well to prove you're not partisan? And Netanyahu has said no.
Yeah, that I don't understand. I mean, he must have a reason, a strategic a strategy for that, but I can't work out why he would say that, because what there's two things going on here. One is the election campaign, and he strides the globe like a colossus as he, you know, strides through Congress and talks to all the great and the good, and then reminds the Israeli electorate that I'm the person that you should be voting for in a couple of weeks. That's the first thing. But the other thing is about Iran. He realizes that in his worldview, the Americans are beginning to go wobbly on Iran. And there's a backstory there, which is about Russia. The Americans take Russia more seriously than they take Iran, and they can't really start dealing too much with Russia until they've dealt with Iran, which is why Russia's about to sell a missile system to Iran. But again, every war is connected. So he's going to Congress to try and blindside the American president. And he's going to say to Congress, no matter what this guy does on Iran, you make sure that you block him. And he wants to speak to both houses. This is where I don't understand why he wouldn't meet the Democrats. He should be meeting everybody he can. I mean, he's pretty good at pressing the flesh. So I haven't worked out yet, and I forgive me for not being able to answer that. I'm interested to try and find out over the next couple of days, what's the problem with meeting these guys? Because he needs bipartisanship in the House.
But I guess it depends on whether he's actually trying to persuade people in America or whether he's trying to persuade people in Israel ahead of the election.
No, but both. He very much needs bipartisan support in the House, not in the White House, but in Congress.
Okay, and just finally, America's most amoral president is set to return this week when season 3 of the hit Netflix series House of Cards finally arrives, ready for binge watching everywhere. Of course, Kevin Spacey joins a long line of actors who've given their own flavour to America's top jobs. Isabel Hilton, Frank Underwood, is he, where's he rank for you in terms of fictional American presidents? Would you be happy if he was the US Commander-in-Chief?
Well, you know, he's, of course, he's, you know, compellingly a watchable character, and it's a great role. But I find it curious that at a time when we have, you know, a benign black president, we have an evil fictional president. And when we had George W. Bush, we had the wonderful West Wing with Bartlett and Martin Sheen's Bartlett. And I think that for a lot of people who felt that, you know, they'd been cast into outer darkness in real life, the West Wing was therapy for years. People watched it thinking, you know, they inhabited if this only alternative universe. Yeah. So I find it slightly odd the other way. But there have been others. And the great thing about fictional presidents is that you can have the president you've never had in real life, you know, the woman, Morgan Freeman, you know, before Obama.
We've had black presidents and female presidents. Absolutely. In fiction before in real life.
And I would watch Morgan Freeman play almost anything. So he's on my list.
Tim Marshall, are these people on your list? Or in fact, do you hark back to the original British series of House of Cards?
I'm afraid, and yearn
after Francis Urquhart?
No, I'm at a distinct disadvantage. I have not seen House of Cards. The House of Marshall doesn't watch it. Nor did I watch The West Wing, which
you
I
never watched.
I know. It's a huge cultural gap in my knowledge. I am aware of Martin Sheen. I think he's marvelous and all the rest of it. But no, I never watched. I'm not sure that the current president is that benign. He's tripled airstrikes in Pakistan and drones. I don't see him as any different to any other American president in that respect. But I would end on my two favorite. Well, my favorite actor who played a president, and that was Ronald Reagan.
Right.
But my favourite fictional president of all time by a country mile is Mayor Quimby in The Simpsons, who, without a shadow of a doubt, is based on John F. Kennedy. Without question, he says things like, ask not what Springfield can do for you, but what you can do for Springfield. I mean, he's channeling. He is JFK, and they've just stuck him in there in Springfield, and it's a wonderful and quite subtle view of the American president.
Isabel, what does this say about us, that we sort of will look at a character like Frank Underwood, who is, let's face it, actually a nasty piece of work? In fact, without spoiling anything for anyone who hasn't... Oh, no, no, it's honest.
I think anyone who strays into House of Cards probably knows he's a nasty piece of work.
He's a murderer. Let's put it out there. I think you can say that on radio about a fictional character. I'm sure you can. you know, but the fact is, there is something about him that, as a character, that certainly appeals, isn't there?
Well, yeah, we like bad guys, don't we? But I think it also speaks to the fact that we're a lot more disillusioned with politics than we have been for a very long time. And basically, we think they're all a bunch of crooks and, you know, out for themselves. And he gives you the satisfaction of being so explicitly that way that, you know, what's left? So that's, I think that's the kind of psychic role that he's playing for the viewer at this point. It would be very hard, I think, to devise a convincing political series at present that people would enjoy that had politicians played as, you know, upright moral characters. It's not the way, it's not the zeitgeist.
And Tim Marshall, is there, you know, do you think there's a reason why in the UK there hasn't really been a great political drama that's put you right at the centre of Downing Street for so long? We've had obviously the original House of Cards, which I must say, if you look at it again now, is actually quite dated and far camper than I ever remembered.
Yes, Prime Minister holds up pretty well, actually.
Yes. No, indeed. Although, despite the fact it was a comedy, it actually was unerringly accurate. I guess, Tim Marshall, again, on that same theme, we've had The Thick of It and the film In the Loop.
I was just going to mention that in The Thick of It. I mean, you know, some of the international audience will not be, because it's very, very British, In the Thick of It.
Although it's, you know, it's written by the same people that wrote Veep.
Yes,
US,
and Amanda,
which is very similar.
Amanda Iannucci has gone over and done Veep, which has gone around the world. I think we don't do it quite as well because we don't have quite the amount of money that the American networks put into their production. Now, we do it pretty well, and there's some big players. There's Sky B, ITV, BBC, and they do put money into drama. But they still haven't in the multi millions. But the British are going to get there. The British will one day come up with a very, very glossy multi-series political thriller like that, and it'll sell around the world. But I'm not sure we've really matched the Americans. I mean, look, it's the same with the sitcoms. You look at Friends. You know, I don't think any country has matched that yet.
But there was a small country which did this, and that was Denmark with Borgen. That's went around the world, and actually was rather brilliant.
It was indeed.
If a bit depressing.
Hey, it's Denmark. But,
that's Denmark, and that's politics. Just when we were talking about politicians on screen, no one mentioned Mary McDonnell as President Laura Roslin in Battlestar Galactica. I thought you two would have known that one. Anyway.
But I could talk about The Day After Tomorrow, which was an equally silly film.
Oh, yes, that was,
wasn't
it?
Where the American president ends up as a refugee in Mexico.
Yes.
That's pretty exciting.
And there was a period where a lot of vice presidents always looked like evil Dick Cheney lookalikes, didn't they?
I wonder why that was.
There we are. Okay, Isabel Hilton and Tim Marshall, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monaco 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
In the final half hour here on Midori House, we will be talking to our man in Madrid, Liam Aldous. We'll also hear from the author of a new book chronicling the tumultuous rise and fall of designers Alexander McQueen and John Galliano. And since we talk about TV, we'll talk about TV a bit more. We'll discuss the finale of a much-loved TV favourite.
So, Doctor, what do we do? What do we do?
The first thing you do is you forget everything that I said before, because you, young lady, need a lot of rest, and especially avoiding stress. Leslie, I need you to be Buddha on Quaaludes, and Ben, you are Matthew McConaughey in a hammock on the beach.
Discussing the finale of NBC's Parks and Recreation with the New York Times' Alessandra Stanley. That's all to come right here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield.
From Monday the 2nd of March, Monocle 24 will be sounding even smarter and sharper thanks to a fresh new season lineup. Hear Monocle's editors in conversation with inspirational names every week on The Big Interview. We'll look back at the news week that was on The Recap. Our brilliant musical guests get a billing of their own on the sessions at Midori House. All this alongside our unrivaled mix of tracks and insight and opinion from Monocle's bureau around the globe. Tune in and listen today at monocle.com via our app or on iTunes or SoundCloud. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, 1833 here in London, 1033 if you're in San Francisco. But we're heading now to Madrid, where our correspondent Liam Aldous is standing by. Liam, welcome to Monocle 24 and Midori House. A couple of things to get talking about, but first, let's talk politics and Spain's State of the Nation debate. Tell us what happened.
Well, enthralling stuff, Steve. Usually these debates are actually quite boring, if I can use that in a very bold word. But this year, it's an election year, so the parties have got off to a head start and have started their electoral campaigns. But unfortunately, they didn't really have an inspiring vision to offer the Spaniards. They just basically became embroiled looked like a childish match of bickering between the two main leaders. So Rajoy started it off with his speech. Prime Minister Rajoy, he basically had a very triumphant tone, talking about how Spain had emerged from the crisis and things are all going to pan out quite well in the coming months and years. The worst is over. He even talked about the fact that his government avoided a bailout, basically. all the measures they took stopped Spain from having to imitate countries like Greece. But then when Pedro Sanchez, who is actually the new opposition leader, took to the pulpit, he refuted all of these claims, basically saying that Spain did actually get a bailout. They had a near 40 billion euro banking bailout shortly after Rajoy took government. And then just heavily criticized what Rajoy said, causing the Prime Minister to come back onto the pulpit and call the opposition leader pathetic. And then from there on, it just it got even worse. They just basically started insulting each other.
Is the only person that's going to be happy with this Pablo Iglesias, the leader of Podemos?
Well, at Pablo Iglesias, there's also Albert Rivera. So there's actually another party coming up in the polls, not as strongly as Podemos, but Albert Rivera is seen as the kind of centre-right alternative to the conservative PP party. It's actually a Catalan party, but will actually be running for seats all across the country in the general elections. And Albert Rivera was actually rated or ranked one of the most favoured politicians in the country in a recent poll. So people who are a little scared off by Podemos's somewhat extremely left-wing rhetoric some of the time are actually casting their vote or their voting intention to this citizens' party by Albert Rivera, which seems a lot more moderate. So both of these parties will be rubbing their hands with glee at the very childish antics that we saw yesterday from the two main leaders.
You say childish antics, although, you know, supporters of Pedro Sanchez might say, well, look, OK, maybe the language was slightly over the top, but the points he was making were quite valid. He's saying, I'm clean, but you're linked to scandals. You don't trust the people you govern because you don't know them. Get out of your plasma screen, go out on the streets, referring to his habit of appearing at press conferences via video link. You know, those accusations aren't necessarily unfounded, are they?
It's true. He did make a lot of good points. He came out really guns a-blazing in a way, because he has been criticised by some of the people within his party for not actually getting an electoral advantage, particularly in the face of Podemos. So he really had nothing to lose. The problem with his speech was that he focused mainly on criticisms and not too much on inspiring the nation, which I think was his strong point last year. Maybe he's tried to change tactics a little, but he runs the risk of just appearing too negative. It's very easy to criticise Rajoy, and it needs to be done to really set himself apart, but he really needs to inspire Spaniards and keep that moderate, inspirational tone that he had last year, I think.
OK. And finally, Liam, swindlers get swindled. Explain all.
Well, this is a very interesting story. I chose it. It came out a couple of days ago. I chose it because the Madrid Art Fair article starts today. But this scandal actually happened in Girona in Catalonia. Basically, a couple of swindlers who bought an artwork which turned out to be fake. So they were swindled from the get-go. Then tried to pawn it off to a sheikh from an unspecified country in the Middle East for 4 million euros. But the sheikh actually swindled them by providing them with photocopied or counterfeit banknotes, 1.7 million Swiss francs. And they only found out that the banknotes were fake when they tried to cash them in at a Geneva bank. So it seems like there was a long trail of swindling just involving one artwork, which is quite comical news story.
Okay, well, for anyone going to Arco, Art Contemporary in Madrid, they should perhaps just be a little more careful. Not that anything wrong would ever go there, obviously, but, you know, if you're buying art.
Yeah, make sure you have your certificate of authenticity, which is apparently what sparked this. The lack of a certificate of authenticity sparked this long chain of swindling in the first place.
There we are. Liam Aldous joining us from Madrid. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll take a look back at the career highs and lows of two icons of the fashion world, Alexander McQueen and John Galliano.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly audio guide to the world's best business minds. From industry giants and family outfits to the one-man bands and clever upstarts.
We saw all this immense amount of frustration by young people finding their first jobs, their second jobs, internships. And we said it's ridiculous that in this day and age, with all the technology we have, we can't solve that.
Tune in at 1900 hours London time every Wednesday to hear insider tips, big challenges, and sparks of insight. We take an hour-long tour of the worlds of fashion to food, timepieces to tech, and hear the founding stories of some of the smartest names around.
I remember saying, deliver beer in New York City. I can hardly afford my car insurance, so I'm going to insure a truck.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Pictet.
Global affairs, culture, business, design, or urbanism, at Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas, or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. It's 1841 here in London and 1341 in New York City. As the 1980s blurred into the early 1990s, two boys from working-class Britain were taking their first steps into the world of fashion. In the years to come, Alexander McQueen and John Galliano would prove to be two of the most striking forces London's rebellious art and club scene had ever encountered. And against many expectations, their effect on the age-old world of French couture was much the same. But as they say, the higher you climb, the further you fall. And that was indeed true for these two iconic names. Dana Thomas chronicles these stories in her new book, Gods and Kings. And she joins me here in the studio today. Dana, welcome to Midori House.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
What is it about these two men that you think that captivated you as a story? Because as you were saying, you know, there was a real sort of rise and fall to both of them in very different ways.
Absolutely. I knew when I was covering their careers for the last 25 years, attending their shows, going to their showrooms, meeting with them in their studios, watching them work, that they were beyond the average fashion designer, that they were doing really great work. I mean, their shows were spectacular and theatrical. We all knew that. And when the clothes came out, they were really mind-blowing at times, just so beautiful and thought out and constructed extraordinarily well and in colors and in richness. But then when we saw the retrospective of McQueen's work at the Met 4 years ago, it just became clear that he was most definitely an artist, and I would say the same of John. And his clothes will be on display this spring at the Metropolitan Museum of Art as part of their show on China. And I think it will become clearer the artistry of his work as well.
Is it, you know, some supporters of Alexander McQueen may be slightly uneasy about him being bracketed with John Galliano because of John Galliano's, you know, very different and very public fall from grace. And of course, you begin the book, you know, with this, you know, moment in Galliano's life, that episode at Paris Cafe where he's, you know, hurling anti-Semitic abuse. This is not a man who comes across as a good character, is it?
Well, certainly not in the beginning. At the end of a chapter of his life, an act in his life, I'd say a three-act life. We're watching the third act unfurl now. But I think that it's the reason I put them together was because they not only did they both come from working-class England and not much money, and were gay boys who were bullied in their youth, and both went to Central Saint Martin's. Yes, a decade apart, but had many of the same teachers, and both were hired by, got their big break from Bernard Arnault, the head of LVMH, at Givenchy successively. But also, I wanted to show how lucky we were to have both of them creating this incredible work at the same time, sort of running against each other. Galliano was always looking forward, and McQueen was always looking at Galliano and trying to do better than Galliano. And at times, even Galliano admitted that McQueen had passed him by creatively. And so they were pushing each other so hard to outdo each other. And at the same time, they were pulling everybody up to their level. Everyone else paled in comparison unless you worked harder because they had set the bar so high. But they did have their different ways of working. McQueen even said very clearly, you know, when somebody asked him one time, and he said, "John's the artist and I'm the realist." And so I wanted to also show their contrast. I mean, it's a clear comparison and contrast story, and that they were running parallel, and they did burn out almost simultaneously, but they did so in completely different ways, for different reasons and same reasons, both. They had different demons, but they were under the same pressures.
When you look at Galliano's, you know, attempt at a comeback now, how comfortable do you think people are within the fashion world about it? Because, you know, what happened, you know, 5 years ago was, you know, this wasn't a sort of a throwaway remark or something that could have been interpreted. I mean, it was vile.
It was really unacceptable, as parents like to say. I think that his return is mixed. I think it's really fair to say it's mixed. A colleague of mine, a confrère, named Robin Gavon, did one of the most important reporting stories about John's return, something that nobody else thought of doing, which was go and talk to retailers and ask them, what do your customers say about this? And customers weren't all very happy, particularly in the United States, particularly among the Jewish community, which is in New York and in the major cities a big part of the buying community. And also for companies like Dior and Oscar de la Renta, where John Galliano was talking about going, much of their high-end sales is for bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs, big Jewish celebrations, and they didn't want to lose that business. So people, the Jewish community is saying that you know, people can redeem themselves and you must, you know, once someone atones, you should forgive them, but it's still hard and they're having a hard time taking it. His old friends and followers are applauding his return, but he's wisely taking baby steps back into it. You know, he doesn't want to just step back in the spotlight, and I think that's the right way to go.
And let's end on a more positive note. When the retrospective of Alexander McQueen's work was produced recently, people said, "Well, looking back now, actually, I think we're realizing exactly what we've lost in a way that perhaps not everyone did at first." Do you share that view? That actually,
absolutely,
the more that, you know, we look back on what he created, we'll realize what was actually there.
Absolutely, and it became very apparent at the exhibit, which will be opening at the Met or at the V&A in a couple weeks. When we were watching his career unfurl, we saw the shows every 3 or 6 months, and each one was remarkable, and we were taken aback by them. But when you see them all in context, one after the other, and presented in one long story, one long narrative, it suddenly becomes apparent what an extraordinary talent he was, and how lucky we were to have had him that brief time.
Dana Thomas, thank you very much indeed. The book is called Gods and Kings, The Rise and Fall of Alexander McQueen and John Galliano. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. So, since we were talking about the return of America's most feared president, Frank Underwood, this weekend, let's take a trip back a few years to when Kevin Spacey won an Oscar for his role in the 1999 film American Beauty. And you might remember this from the film's climax. It's Annie Lennox with Don't It Bring You Down.
Cold wind ripping down the the road with the daylight in his eyes. Don't let it bring you down. It's only castles burning. Find someone who's turning, and you will come around. You will come around. Blind man running through the light of the night with an answer in his hand. Come on down to the river of sight, and you can be.
That was Annie Lennox there with Don't Let It Bring You Down from the soundtrack to the 99 Oscar-winning film American Beauty. We were hoping to speak to Alessandra Stanley in New York. We've had a slight problem with the phone. So instead, let's hear from our technology correspondent, David Phelan. A little bit earlier, he was talking to Tom Edwards.
Panasonic, like Samsung, have a habit of staging a European event at the beginning of the year so they can show all the products that they've shown in America, some of them, but also the ones that aren't going to make it to America, that are designed for Japan or European markets specifically. And Panasonic had a lot to show, everything from washing machines with bigger doors so that it's easier to load your clothes in and out of them, to an epilator which has the same kind of battery as a Tesla car. They were very proud to make that connection.
Yes. Is that a strong selling suit for such a device?
I don't know. It seems a very confusing thing. Obviously, it's a smaller battery. I don't want to give you the impression it's the same size or power. But it's yes. No, it was a slide that played well in the room.
There we go. And anything kind of surprising, or that? I mean, I guess that's quite surprising.
Yeah.
In and of itself. Or was it, as you mentioned, not too many kind of real shocks? The things they're rolling out.
No, sure. I think they were. Panasonic is very eager to say that it is there to please the customer. It made the best plasma TVs in the world, and when people didn't really want plasmas anymore, they finally, only a year or two ago, stopped making them. And this year, for example, they announced this week their first curved TVs, which is a phenomenon that Samsung brought to us. And
Well, no, I was going to say, I remember because we were talking about that and you were saying it had struck you that it was quite interesting that they'd really thrown, Samsung says it, all their sort of weight behind curved. Sure. It's like, that's the future for them. Panasonic the same or more, they're just sort of dipping their toe in that curved TV water, if you will.
Yes, it's more a toe dip at the moment. But in the sense that with Samsung, if you want the best TV that they make, all the best technology, and you have to go for a curved one. Panasonic are making their top-of-the-range TVs effectively in flat and curved so that you can choose. But though they're saying that they're finding their research tells them that curved is proving very popular.
And what kind of features do they have? I gather they have special phosphors.
Yes, this is their big thing.
Tell me more.
Well, one of the recent technologies that Sony had a couple of years ago, LG is now promoting, is called Quantum Dot, which is basically a filter on top of the screen to give more realistic colours. Instead of Quantum Dot, Panasonic is following its own route with its own specially chosen phosphors, which give a wider colour gamut, and again, should give a more realistic TV picture. And they're also going into HDR, high dynamic range, which requires a much brighter television. And they showed a prototype there, which was astonishing. The depth of detail you would get in the shadows and the bright skies was great. Not so good when you went to, say, the Netflix logo, which has a big white background behind it, where you couldn't, it just sears into your eyeballs. Now, they'll have adjusted that before it goes on sale. And they also had an amazing OLED TV, which is also in prototype, which looked extraordinary.
So that's a pretty exciting product there. I guess we might find more of the same at the Mobile World Congress, which is happening soon, I gather.
Yes, that's right. It starts on Monday with some of the announcements, the big announcements from Huawei and HTC and Samsung the day before on the Sunday. And it's really a chance for all the major manufacturers, apart from Apple, who never go to these things, to show their latest and best. HTC and Samsung are known to be producing their flagship phones for the year. So it's a very big time, especially for Samsung, who, you know, really their last flagships haven't quite been as successful as they wanted them to be. And I've been told by Samsung that they're really going to throw everything at this, that especially they've been criticized for not having good enough design. Mm. And I think they will really work at that this Sunday. But, you know, the truth is, it's difficult to stand out. You've got an oblong piece of glass with a metal or plastic back. How do you make it different? This phone here that I'm about to hand you is the LG G Flex 2, which has just been announced, and you will see that it's curved like those TVs.
Curvy, I like this. I prefer the one that had the little, the sort of screen that went, that was wrapped around the side.
Yes, few weeks that ago. Was the that Samsung was Galaxy Note Edge.
But that's quite an attractive sort of piece, isn't it? A sculptural quality to it.
Yes, and it shows you that people need to do something different to stand up. And maybe a curve, the screen that curves round is another way to go. LG also have a self-healing back on that phone. So if you put it in the same pocket with your keys or coins and scratch it over a 10-15 second period, it heals itself, which I tried
that
this
sounds,
morning with
sounds,
a fork.
That sounds frightening. Does that actually work, doesn't it?
It does work. You do get frightened by technology.
A human application for that, maybe. I was unsuccessfully trying to actually make that do anything, but I couldn't work out.
That's because it only has one button on the back. It's hidden away.
That was David Phelan and Tom Edwards, who only has one button on the back hidden away. And that's who we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Tim Marshall and Isabel Hilton. Midori House was produced by Ben Ryland and researched by David Pleasant and Kate Bullivant. The studio manager was Bill Lutey. Next up, after the headlines, Daniel Giacopelli will be here with The Entrepreneurs. Of course, The Daily is here at 2200 hours with Andrew Muller and I believe Emma Nelson. Midori House back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours here in London, 1300 hours in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.